This is off tape. Yeah,
hold it.
I mean, what do you want?
Tell it, and he'll catch it. Roger Chaffee, you are in the number 3 seat in our new Apollo spacecraft, and you are also a new name to many of our listeners. Could you tell us something about yourself? Where were you born in the United States?
I was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the 15th of February, 1935.
That makes you a fairly young man in this business and in flying in general, doesn't it?
Yes, it is. I'm 31. I'll be 32 here in a few days. I've been flying in the Navy for about 9 years now. I guess I'm pretty near the junior man in our office, with the exception of some of the new group of 19 astronauts that we just picked up about 6-8 months ago.
Michigan, that's in the Midwestern United States. It's sort of cold country too there, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's Midwest, on the northern boundaries of the country, and we get a lot of snow. More than our share, as far as I'm concerned, when I'm up there. And it's pretty cold this time of year also.
Tell us something of your educational background and how you got into flying and then on into astronautics.
Well, we'll just assume I had the standard elementary and high school education, and then I decided I wanted to study aeronautical engineering. I went to Purdue University, which is in West Lafayette, Indiana, about 200 miles south of my home in Michigan. I graduated in 1957 with a bachelor's degree in aeronautical engineering. At that time, I was commissioned a ensign in the U.S. Navy and entered flight training. When I finished flight training, I spent 3.5, maybe 4 years in a squadron in Jacksonville, Florida, and was then chosen to go to postgraduate school on an exchange program with the Air Force. I entered the Air Force Institute of Technology at Dayton, Ohio, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and started to work on my master's degree in reliability engineering.
We'll get to what that means a little later.
Right. All these years that I had been flying in the Navy, I say all these, all 4 or 5 of them by that time, I had been putting on my duty preference card, requesting test pilot school so I could be eligible for astronaut training, or requesting recommendation for astronaut training. And sure enough, one day in the mail, I got a letter from Bureau of Naval Personnel that says, "We will recommend you to NASA to try out for astronaut selection if you so desire."
Now, where were we in our space exploration program at that time?
This was about a month after Gordon Cooper's flight, the last Mercury flight. I believe his last Mercury flight was May
63.
Of 63, I think around the 22nd of May, something like that, 1963. And I received this letter from the Navy, I think, on about the 13th of June, 1963.
So you were building your proficiency in naval aviation right at the time of the Mercury flights.
Yes, I was. I was getting most of my flight time and experience during the Mercury program. In fact, I was in a photographic squadron, and we provided high-altitude photographic coverage of the Mercury flights from our station in Jacksonville, Florida. I used to...
The launches?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I used to rendezvous at about, or shall I say, orbit at about 40,000 feet, 35 to 40,000 feet, standing by, and we'd fly a flight pattern to run in on the booster during the launch.
You were one of the chase planes.
One
that
of the chase
see
planes, right. And I took pictures of several of the flights between the altitudes of around 30 and 45,000 feet.
But you couldn't catch those things, could you?
No, there wasn't any danger of overrunning them. They always managed to get away from us.
An Atlas booster was a little faster than a jet airplane.
Yeah, they move out pretty good. So anyway, I was in this reliability program when the notice came from the Navy, and I filled out the papers and sent them in and went through the long selection process, which entails physical examinations, mental examinations, both the psychiatric variety of mental exams and also the engineering, or just a good old school type test.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few personal interviews with various people of NASA. And then one day the good word came, and I was chosen to come on board the astronaut team.
And when was that?
Well, I received notification in October of 1963, and we all had to wrap up our duties in our respective squadrons or schools, wherever we were. And my group of astronauts reported on board in February of 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been in training down here since then, handling our various duties in the space program and preparing ourselves for flight.
You mentioned that you were an alumnus of Purdue University. I believe several other astronauts are Purdue men, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Gus Grissom, who's command pilot on the flight I'm going on, is a Purdue graduate. The next one, if we take them in order of seniority in the program, shall we say, or as who graduated first from Purdue, it's the same way. The next one is Neil Armstrong, who flew on Gemini 8. And the next one is Gene Cernan, who flew on Gemini 9. And Gene and I knew each other at Purdue, by the way, and we're next-door neighbors here in Houston. And then a year after Gene graduated from Purdue, I graduated from Purdue.
Mm-hmm. And who's your wife?
My wife is Martha, the former Martha Horn of Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And I met her at Purdue University also.
And how many children you have, Roger?
Two. I have a girl 8 and a boy 5.
Okay. Hold it a minute, Doyle. I'll put a thank you on that to end it. Thanks very much, Roger, and we'll be talking to you more during the flight. Roger Chaffee, you are what is called the pilot in this first Apollo mission. Now, that means you're in the right-hand seat, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Now, what's over there? What can you see from your position there at takeoff in this big new Apollo spacecraft, besides a lot of space around you?
Well, at takeoff, actually, I won't see very much space or anything outside the spacecraft. I won't see anything. Let me say a few words on that. We have what we call a boost protective cover. You might think of it like a horse blanket. It's a big fabric type material, very stiff, kind of a fiberglass type composition that covers the outside of the spacecraft during the boost phase of flight. The reason for this is because of aerodynamic heating as you're boosting into orbit could scorch the paint on the outside of the spacecraft, start to heat up the ablative covering on the spacecraft. Unlike Gemini and Mercury, which had metal shingles that covered the outside, the Apollo spacecraft has the ablative material all around it, where the Gemini and Mercury just had it on the heat shield. And you don't want to get any preheating of this during boost. So
this ablative material that will burn off during
boost. Right. And the reason the Apollo has it all over is because ultimately, of course, this vehicle will be coming in on lunar trajectories or lunar reentries, coming back from the moon.
A lot more speed, a lot more heat than previous.
A lot more speed, a lot more heat, and you need the ablative material all over. Well, we don't want to get this heated up during boost into orbit and start the ablation process on it at all. So we have this boost protective cover, and well, it just covers up the windows and everything. So until we get rid of our launch escape tower, as we call it, which is a spider-legged device that's up on top of the command module at launch, until we get rid of that, the windows are covered with this boost protective cover. And that goes off at about 2 minutes and 45 seconds after liftoff, and then, of course, we can see. As far as what I see inside the spacecraft from the right-hand seat during boost, the right-hand seat is... You might think of it as a watch station, or if you compare it with a big commercial-type airliner with the flight engineer station. All the systems are controlled and monitored from that station. The electrical system, the environmental control system, the communication systems, the propellant systems for the main engine, varying the mixture ratio of fuel and oxidizer to control combustion in your main engine.
Mm-hmm. Could you say then that Gus Grissom is the? Wait a minute. I was going to just reiterate the aviation comparison.
Well,
the captain of the ship.
Yeah.
Ed White's the co-pilot, and you are the engineer. I'll ask you this question. Then could you say that in comparing it to commercial aviation, Gus Grissom is the captain of the craft, Ed White is co-pilot, and you are the flight engineer. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, it looks something like that, yes, during liftoff. Gus has his hands, you might say, on the controls if he was to take over, say, for an abort or to do attitude control manually during boost or shortly after insertion. Ed is really at what we call the navigation station, but he is sitting next to Gus and can assist him in some of his functions, similar to what a co-pilot does for a captain during takeoff or landing. And then I'm running the systems during this time.
Well, this is very interesting because this is new to us to understand, and also it's nice to have something to compare it to, like a big commercial airliner, which is much more down to earth and within our knowledge sphere.
Yes, I think most people are familiar with the operation or what they've seen pictures and that of insides of the commercial airliners and know the seas. One thing I want to make clear on this or point out is the way we rotate duties during flight. So we want to associate the names command pilot, senior pilot, and pilot more with order of authority or responsibility on board. The command pilot makes all the decisions, of course, like the captain of a ship. If anything were to happen to him, the next man in line would be the senior pilot and then the pilot. And even though we rotate seats during the flight so that we exchange duties, the names don't stay with the seats. The names stay with the people.
Mm-hmm.
Even if Gus is in the right seat, monitoring systems, and I'm in the left seat actually controlling the spacecraft, doing an orbit change burning maneuver where we're thrusting with the main engine, and we do this, we rotate seats, but Gus is still the command pilot over there.
Mm-hmm.
If it came a decision of whether we're going to do that burn or whether we're not, or the decision is to talk about any of the major things that can come up, that would be his decision regardless of who is in the left seat flying it at that time. Of course, once you actually start the flight maneuver, then who's ever doing it, of course, is going to have to make any real-time decisions that come along, because everything happens pretty fast. Once that engine lights off, there's not much time. You've got to be prepared for it.
What does systems engineering mean? Is it the integrating of all of the new instruments and so forth into one whole unit? This is sort of
are you speaking of that with respect to inside the spacecraft, or just the term systems engineering as far as our engineers here in the Apollo program office and at Downey at North American speak of it?
Well, let's apply it to the spacecraft.
Well, okay, the systems engineer applied to the spacecraft is actually, literally, it's just what it says. He is a man that controls the various systems that make the spacecraft go. One system is the electrical system. We have two AC buses, three inverters to produce AC electricity. We have...
A bus is a main channel. Let's explain that.
Right, a main channel of power distribution. We have eight DC buses, direct current buses. And our equipment is split up between all these various buses into subsystems of the electrical system. These buses and loads that go on them, various pieces of equipment, have to be switched at different times during the flight. Sometimes you have to bring additional inverters on the line to carry the AC load. Our DC current is generated from fuel cells, where we combine hydrogen and oxygen in a catalytic or with a catalyst to produce a reaction, and they produce electricity and water. We drink the water afterwards, by the way. We use that for our main water supply. Well, that's another system then, the fuel cell system. And then we have the cryogenic system. This is the
super cold.
The super cold oxygen and hydrogen, which supplies the reactants to the fuel cells. And then we have the environmental control system, which keeps the temperature right in the spacecraft for the crew. It keeps the temperature of all the equipment at the proper operating temperature. This is done by space radiators. We circulate water glycol mixture through the radiators to cool it.
That's sort of an antifreeze, isn't it?
Well, the glycol is the antifreeze, yes, and ours is just about what you'd have in an automobile radiator as far as composition of water glycol. And then we bring this back from the radiators through some pumps, a distribution system, and circulate it through cold plates, as we call them. And these are just hollow metal plates. The water glycol circulates through it, and the black box or the electronic equipment is bolted on top of it, and it keeps it cool. The environmental control system also provides all our breathing oxygen. It handles our water distribution. It heats our water for hot water to mix with some of our dehydrated food if we want it hot. It chills some water, so we have very cold drinking water, which makes it a little more palatable, of course. And it handles the, it encompasses, shall I say, or handles the waste management system.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the communication system. This is also run from the system station and requires a little bit of switching during some of these maneuvers when you're over in that seat. We have two VHF voice links and an S-band voice link.
These are radar units. You say C...
Well, the C-band is really our radar for tracking only. The S-band is everything. We call it the unified S-band equipment.
I got started in the wrong track. Mm-hmm. Track on that completely. I'll just let it go where you said in VHF and S-band, and just let it go.
Okay.
Because I don't want to get into the depths of
the
radar overseas and stuff. Well, Roger, we ask you about systems and about engineering to begin with there, because I happen to have... because in the past I noticed that you have been aggressive in working on engineering problems. I've heard you be quite strongly... I've heard you express your opinions quite strongly on some of the systems and problems that you've had to overcome in the past, and so I just got the impression that you were quite aggressive in working out problems when it comes to systems engineering.
Oh, I see. Well, my background, my training, of course, was to be an engineer and a pilot, and I like both of them very much, and so I enjoy getting in and tackling a good down-to-earth practical engineering problem that comes along.
Thank you, Roger Chaffee. Hold it a minute, Doyle. Remember?
Just a minute.
Roger Chaffee, you have been watching the experiments package rather closely for this Apollo mission. Could you run through the scientific, medical, and technical experiments which are to be conducted on the mission?
Sure, I'd be glad to. We're not as heavily loaded with experiments as some of the Gemini flights have been, but we have... quite a few, or several, I should say, and they're all important to the space program. Of course, the biggest experiment's the spacecraft itself, and that's the big objective of the first flight of any new vehicle or new spacecraft, is to prove that it's going to work. And so we have about 60 or 70 objectives that we call experiments, because they're handled the same way we did experiments in Gemini. A specific time in the flight, we go in and we do a specific maneuver or a specific systems test. Maybe it takes an hour, maybe it takes 5 minutes, maybe 10 hours. But this is to pull an experiment, you might say, on a certain system or a certain piece of equipment in the spacecraft. Now, in addition to the mission objectives type experiments, we have about 7 medical experiments, 3 of which take onboard or real-time participation by the flight crew during the flight itself. The others are just pre- and post-flight blood analysis, calcium depletion of the bone analysis, conditioning, that's actual physical conditioning of the crew, things like that. Mm-hmm. So they just require a little testing beforehand and testing after the flight. The 3 medical experiments that require participation in flight is a otolith experiment, as we call it, where it's trying to see if there's any disturbance to the inner ear due to the lack of gravity, and this is what controls a person's balance, sense of direction, you might say. It's to see if we can become disoriented with goggles over our eyes where we can't see the, say, the control panel of the spacecraft. We lose our sight reference. One of the other ones is a... it's a lower body support garment. It's a known fact. If people spend a great deal of time in bed, in bed rest, then when they get up, blood tends to pool in their legs from lack of, shall we say, muscle tone or exercise during long periods. Well, it's been hypothesized that this might happen to astronauts over long periods of flight. So if we run this flight for 14 days, say, there's a possibility this could happen. They wanted to check this, and there's been some of this noted in the past.
Nothing. Now, we've jokingly called it Ed White's girdle, haven't we?
Right, and Ed's going to wear this support garment, and you can think of it as a girdle. It's a full-length girdle, though, that runs from his ankles to his midsection, a very tight, elastic garment. And Ed will put this garment on about 5 hours prior to re-entry and wear it until after he's back on the ship. And they will compare how it reacts or how he reacts this time compared to how he reacted on his last flight when he didn't wear this.
Make it a little more synoptic.
Okay. Then the other one is just monitoring of the heart noise. They'll compare the noise of the heart to the electrical impulse of the heart. It's a pretty straightforward one.
That's been done before in
Gemini.
Yes,
it has. Then we have what we call one technical experiment, and it's just an aerosol or a particle sampler. It takes in a sample of air, and it counts how many particles are of a certain size or in so much volume of air. It's to determine how good our environmental control system is at cleaning up the spacecraft.
The new unit for the new spacecraft.
Right, that's exactly it. Then we have, of course, our scientific experiments. We have four of them, and they're all photographic. The two old Gemini standbys, synoptic terrain and synoptic weather photography. And then we have a dim light photography, which is trying to get photographs of sunrise and sunset, the air glow layer. Then we have an international experiment that's going to be done with the French government, and this is a sodium vapor cloud photographic experiment.
Thank you, Roger Chaffee.
Then just the vapor cloud itself.
Yeah.
Roger, we tried this. Roger, we tried to photograph this sodium vapor cloud during the Gemini 12 mission, and it was very difficult for the astronauts to see. This is to be done again on the first Apollo flight. Could you explain how we hope to have success this time, how you can align the spacecraft better in this case?
This experiment was tried on Gemini 12, and we're going to try it again on our flight. And I think the flight crew is very excited about this one for two reasons. One is we're working with another country on it. It takes a lot of cooperation. Our control center at Houston is talking with the control center at Hamaguir with the French.
That's in North Africa.
Right, and they're coordinating times. We're telling the French when we'll be at a certain point in space, and they're going to launch their rockets, which will leave a sodium vapor trail. Let's see, I think it's going to be between about 70 and 200 miles. Now, this rocket's being launched when we're about 1,000, about 650 miles away, 1,000 kilometers.
That's about 100 to 300 kilometers up into space, right?
Right. And we'll be about 1,000 kilometers away when they launch this. Now, the big problem in this experiment is trying to see it. They had some goggles on Gemini 12, and since then, the goggles have been improved. These goggles let you just see a certain wavelength or a certain color of light, and it tries to blank out some of the other colors of light in the spectrum.
As I recall, the desert is very bright. The bright Sahara there almost overwhelms light from everything else.
Right, it does. It makes this cloud very hard to see, but with these goggles and the improved ones that we have on this flight, I think we'll have a better chance of seeing the cloud ourselves. Plus, the big advantage of Apollo and the way we can pick this up is we can align our stable platform or our inertial unit an hour or two before the launch, say on the previous orbit. We'll have this all aligned as we're coming up for this sodium rocket. And we'll have this platform aligned on the stars, so it'll be very accurate. Well, then the ground, by knowing the location where they're going to launch it and the flight path, the French will generate sighting angles from our orbit, exact direction we can point our spacecraft with respect to this stable platform that we have aligned on the stars. So as we're coming up from Bermuda across the Atlantic Ocean, we'll fly to this attitude and have our windows pointed right at the place in space where this cloud is to be emitted. In the event that we don't see anything, we'll go ahead and start our cameras rolling at the precise time that the French tell us to. And we'll take one exposure every second for a period of about 5 minutes here. And so I'm quite confident we'll get something off this, because if we're pointed in the right direction and we're taking a picture every second, if the cloud's there, we'll get some pictures of it.
Well, can you explain what the study of the vapor cloud is for? What's the scientific purpose?
Okay, they're really trying to measure extremely high winds, winds at altitudes that people don't fly at in airplanes even today. Winds up around 100 miles in the movement of the atmosphere.
160 kilometers
right.
up.
And they'll have this vapor trail up there, and over a five-minute period, it will be displaced in the photographs, and they'll be able to get their measurements off this of what the direction and velocity
by following
the currents
current.
Are. Right, by following it. Then on the next revolution around, where there should be some remnants or traces of the clouds still left.
This would be an hour and a half later.
Right, and they think there still might be some around, and if there is, or even if there isn't, we will start the cameras again, point our spacecraft at a certain place in space, start the cameras, and if there's anything there, it should show up on this film that is, it's really sensitized to pick up this sodium color, or the wavelength of light given off by sodium vapor. So if it's there, I think we'll probably get some pictures of it.
Well, I think this could be the first of many such cooperative experiments. Well, I think this could be the first of many such cooperative experiments with other nations, don't you?
Yes, I do, and it's real interesting. The people that were concerned and the originator of the experiment, the director of the program from France, came down to Kennedy Space Center and came up to the crew quarters and gave the flight crew a briefing on the experiment and what the purpose was, and we sat there and talked about different cameras and how we'd point the spacecraft, and wonderful gentleman to meet.
Thank you very much, Roger Chaffee, and good luck throughout the flight.
Thank you.
Shall we all have a cup of coffee?